Okay, we're gonna get started. Hello, everyone. My name is Nicolas Garcia Belmonte, and I'm here with Luz Caballero. And today we're gonna be talking about getting started with WebGL. So first of all, a few words about me. I work for a company called Sencha. They build HTML5 frameworks, UI frameworks. I lead the graphics team at Sencha, so we build data visualization, charting frameworks that work cross-browser. And I play a lot with web standards to create these data visualizations. So everything related with SVG, VML, 2D canvas, WebGL, stuff like that.
Hi, I'm Luz. I'm a web opener at Opera, and I evangelize web standards. That means that I make sure that developers have the knowledge and the resources to use web standards instead of proprietary technologies. So today we will be talking about how to get started with WebGL. And I don't think that we can cover everything you need to know about WebGL in an hour, but what we want to do is sort of break the ice. So after this talk, you can go and get started, and all the research that you would need to have done has already been done for you. So what we're going to mention is what WebGL is, what you can use it for, how it works, and then some tips on getting started, and we're going to show some frameworks, what a 3D scene looks like, and some code, and then some more resources that you may need to do it on your own later. So what is WebGL? So I'm going to show a demo here. So WebGL is a web standard that allows you to create 3D hardware accelerated graphics for the web. And as you can see, you can load pretty decent, pretty large models and also materials, create reflections and shadows, and also, of course, animations and movements. And as you can see, it's pretty smooth. So let's talk a little bit about the background and the history of WebGL. So WebGL is an API created by the Kronos Group, the same guys that created OpenGL, which is the graphics API for desktop computers that later evolved into OpenGL ES for mobile phones. And now there's a web standard based on the same API that is supported by most browsers. So because it is based on OpenGL, and it was meant to be that way so that people who already knew how to use OpenGL could pretty easily adapt their coding skills to the web, the API may not look like your typical web API. It's a little bit more low level, but luckily there are libraries, JavaScript libraries, that provide a complete wrapper around the raw WebGL API that you can use. So if you know your JavaScript, you can pretty easily create some WebGL too with these libraries. This is what we're going to be talking about later. So where is WebGL supported? So WebGL is supported in most browsers right now. It is supported in Opera Next, which is the alpha version of the Opera 12, the next version that will be coming. In Firefox, in Chrome, in Safari, if you enable it. So it doesn't come enabled by default, but you can enable it. And in mobile, in Opera and Firefox. So there are also polyfills for Internet Explorer that you can use that will use Canvas, 2D Canvas, instead of WebGL when it's not supported. So how does WebGL look like, or how do you get it into your code on your website? WebGL is a context of the Canvas element. So basically what you have to do is what you're seeing right now, super simple. You have to create a canvas element And then through JavaScript, you grab the WebGL context, and you can use it to draw whatever you want. In some browsers, WebGL is still more experimental. So if you try to get the WebGL context and it doesn't work, it throws a null. So then you can use experimental-webgl, and that should work. So this is what WebGL is, but what can it be used for? So usually when I talk to people about WebGL, they think of shiny demo stuff, that, and it's hard to think of real-life uses, right? Because this is such a new technology. But one thing that we would like to show in this presentation, and one important bit about getting started, is to figure out how you can use it in your real life, whatever applications that you are creating. So we're going to demo some uses. This is by no means everything that can be done with WebGL. There are a lot more stuff that, things that can be done. But some of them are data visualization, creative coding, art, 3D design environments, music videos, plotting mathematical functions, 3D modeling of objects and space, creating textures, and also one interesting thing that you don't usually see is that WebGL can actually be used for fast processing of any kind of data. So whatever you feel that will be really heavy and you would like to throw into the GPU, you can do it. So even, for example, audio, if you need to process audio super fast, you can use it and you can get it into your GPU using WebGL and then bring it back to audio and keep on doing whatever you were doing. So these are some of the demos. So the first one I'm going to show, I hope this works. It's data visualization. So this is an interactive visualization of temperature changes in the last century or so. This was created with data from NASA. So this is NASA imagery. And the colors have been mapped into volume around a 3D model of the Earth. And as you can see, you can interact with it. You can see the different changes in temperature, in time. And it animates pretty smoothly. It actually is super helpful when you think that an animation will make a point, like right here. When you start and you see that it was actually pretty cold, like 150 years ago, and then if you look closer to where we are now, you see it getting hotter and hotter and even hotter. So this sometimes it helps making a really good point. So this is creative coding, which is actually just creating beautiful things out of mathematical functions or animations. This is the real-time rendering of a fractal in which you change the initial conditions as you move the mouse, and you have it. You have the fractal equation rendered as you go. So what you are seeing are not animations in that sense, are just how the equation changes as the initial conditions shift. So this is super interesting because usually when you see, well, at least to me, because usually when you see a fractal, you just see one state based on some initial conditions, and here you can see it happening live. It's also beautiful. This was made, by the way, and the last one too, with PhiloGL, which is one of the libraries that we're going to show later. So next is just art, beautiful things. So this is pretty cool. I like this one a lot. If you are familiar with the work of MC Esker, this is nice because it just, I think, to me, it feels like it augments Esker's work in a way that, I mean, I think he would have found pretty cool, right? if you're familiar with this artwork. It looks pretty cool how you can move it around and see it from a different perspective. This was done with 3.js. But let's if moving into less artistic uses and more practical, this is a demo I want to show. But I'm not sure, let's see if it loads, because we couldn't find a local copy of this one. It was pretty hard to get the textures to download yesterday because the network is not great. Let's wait a tiny bit more. If not, I'm just going to show. Can you see the car in there? Not very well. Okay, but what I'm just trying to show it real quick like this. What you can do is you have a car and you can add stuff to it. You can add different things. I don't know, whatever you want. It looks much better, actually, when the textures download. You can try this later by yourselves. Oh, there, I got some of it. Oh, there it is. Also, music videos. This one is pretty cool, too. Pretty artistic. See if it loads. Okay, maybe not. Okay, I'll just move on. So another use is plotting mathematical functions. This is a pretty cool, practical use, too, that I wish I had had when I was studying these things. So what you can do is, here is the function. You can also make it a function of time and animate it, which makes it pretty cool to see what's actually going on. So here's another one. You can also see it as a grid and play it, which is super interesting. And this was also made with PhiloGL. And one that I find very cool is creating 3D models of objects or space. This is a real model taken from, this is a brain, by the way. This was created using real MRI data from 15 average human brains. The data is from McGill University, and they are creating an application to allow scientists to see this data on the web, data about different brain regions and functions. And this is pretty cool too. This was done with PhiloGL also. And we're going to explain later a little bit about how you can create this. Then there are also games, obviously. I think everyone knows that WebGL can be used to create games. This is a pretty cool game called Emberwind. I'm not going to demo this one because tomorrow at 12:30 in this same room, I think, Eric Muller from Opera will be showing this and will be explaining how to create HTML5 games. So if you're interested in WebGL and gaming, you should. I think you should be here. It's going to be pretty interesting. And finally, creating textures. So what this means is, for example, here I have. I'm going to add some more light to this because it's kind of dark. So here, what you have is a 3D model of two objects that are orbiting each other. And what you can do, for example, with this is make it into a texture for a different model. So when this finishes turning around, you will see that the model that I showed right before is used as a live texture for the screen in this one. So now Niklas is going to explain a bit about how WebGL works and what happens under the hood when all these models are rendered.
Thanks. So I hope that the examples you saw got you inspired to give you new ideas, maybe to use WebGL to do work. But what I think it's also interesting is also to find out what's happening under the hood when you're rendering these things onto 3D. This is maybe not some necessary thing you need to know in order to use a framework to create a 3D scene, but it's something that it's definitely valuable when you're using WebGL. So what I'm going to try to explain is, from the JavaScript side, when you want to render something into WebGL, what's happening under the hood? Basically, what's the rendering pipeline? So it all starts on the upper right part corner of the of this slide. So basically, you have a data structure, a JavaScript data structure, which is can be a vertex array, an array of floats, right? So each value would be an XYZ value, coordinate in 3D space, in this case. And using the WebGL JS JavaScript API, you can send this information through buffers to the GPU. And then it goes through the rendering pipeline. So what does it mean? It means that it goes first over to some shader code, which is called a vertex shader. And the vertex shader, what it does is it manipulates this 3D data, for example, to rotate the points, to scale the points, to translate the points. So the vertex shader has this responsibility of changing the values of the vertex array. Then it goes from the vertex shader over to another phase, which is called the triangle assembly, which cannot be manipulated by the developer, but it's something that actually happens within the GPU. And the triangle assembly, what it does is it takes all these vertices and it creates faces out of that, because we don't want to render points, but we want to render, you know, a shape. So we need to create faces out of these triangles, out of these points. The faces in generally are quads or triangles. From the triangle assembly phase, this information is sent to the rasterization process. And the main idea behind the rasterization process is to take this 3D model and to transform it into pixels, right? Because it's going to be rendered into a screen, so it is made out of pixels. So it kind of projects this 3D model onto the screen. And the good thing about the rasterization process is that it then sends this over to a fragment shader, which is something that, as a developer, you can change. It's a programmable model. And the fragment shader, what it does, it's the fragment shader is called per pixel. So per each pixel of this shape or face, the fragment shader is called, and you can change the color of the face. So this is where you can do some nice effects like a fog effect or reflections and things like that. So from the JavaScript side, you have the code in your JavaScript, and you have the WebGL JS API, which connects all these arrays of data with the GPU part. And the GPU is a compiled program. It consists of this vertex shader and this fragment shader, which are compiled into a program. And both the vertex shader and the fragment shader can also be coded by a developer. It's not coded in JavaScript, but it's called in something called a shading language, which resembles a lot the C programming language, but it has a lot of extensions to manipulate, to do math easily, basically to manipulate matrices and vectors. And you don't really need to code this. Frameworks generally provide some default shaders. But if you want to fine-tune what you're doing, then it's a good idea to read more about the shading language. At the right, what you can see is the main data structures, which are sent to these vertex shaders and fragment shaders. So of course, they have some input, and they output something. So the main input they have is in form of attributes and uniforms, which basically are floats or arrays of floats values. And this same information, you can send it from JavaScript to the fragment shader and from the vertex shader to the fragment shader. So I hope that made a little bit better, you know, what's really happening under the hood when you're rendering something. And maybe now that you have this knowledge, it can be pretty interesting to know, well, how to actually get started.
Okay, so as you can see from that explanation, what actually happens is pretty complex, what happens to get your scene rendered. So, but what you actually need to know to just to get started is pretty simple. So what does a 3D scene consist of? So the main elements of the 3D scene and the things that are more are just important for you to know to get started and on which everything will be added on later are you have the objects, the models that are inside your scene. That would be the shapes right there. So these objects can be created. These objects are created out of the vertices that we saw at the beginning of the rendering pipeline. These vertices can be created dynamically in your JavaScript, or they can be uploaded from a model that you can create on any 3D graphics software from Maya to Google SketchUp or whatever you want. Then you have a camera that provides the viewpoint. And it actually, where you place the camera will determine what you're seeing in your view plane. And then you have lights. And these lights in WebGL can be different kinds of lights. It can be, they can be point lights or ambient lights or directional lights. But these are the main elements to have in mind when you're starting. Later, you can add materials and textures and reflections or shadows, as we saw in the Hello Racer, the car demo that I showed. So the next thing that you have to do is choosing a library. What libraries will do for you mainly are provide all these objects. They will provide the camera. They will provide the API to create all these different objects, the lights, etc. So there are several WebGL libraries that you can choose from. They provide slightly different things, and they are slightly different. Ones may be better than others depending on the purpose and what you want to create. So the first one is 3JS. 3JS is the largest and also the most popular library. So what's very good about it is that it has a large community that shares demos and knowledge, and you can ask questions from. They also, using 3JS, you can also import from many different formats. For example, Collada or Wavefront OBJ files or whatever, almost actually, whatever your 3D graphics software exports to. Then you have PhiloGL that Nicholas created. And PhiloGL is smaller, but it's also more manageable. It has very complete documentation. And it's structured in a way that will be probably very or more familiar to people that are proficient in JavaScript already. And then there's GLGE that has some interesting stuff like skeletal animations or animated textures and J3D and probably many more, I don't know. So once you have chosen your library, you can, because this is JavaScript, you can use whatever development environment you use regularly for your JavaScript. What you will need is a browser that supports WebGL in order to test your application. So one of the interesting things for me is when testing or when creating my a WebGL application is that it's kind of interesting what Touch and WebGL combined can create, right? When you have a Touch interface and a 3D object and you can sort of manipulate it around. So we haven't seen yet many WebGL mobile applications, but I think it's an interesting thing to create. And for that, I think what I've been using is Opera Mobile and Dragonfly, the remote debugging that has come in handy, and it has been pretty cool to test WebGL in mobile and to develop WebGL in mobile. So now I will let Niklas explain a little bit more about WebGL and to show you some code and how you can actually create an application.
Thanks. So I'm going to be talking a little bit more about PhiloGL now, which is a framework I've been developing for the last year and a half. Since I work more with web standards to create data visualizations, PhiloGL is more oriented towards creating data visualizations. So thinking about your float arrays in JavaScript as data and how to manipulate that data to create nice visual things with it. So the main philosophy behind the framework is that if you have an HTML document, then most of the people that create frameworks for WebGL think about a WebGL app as a huge WebGL canvas that occupies the entire screen and doesn't interact with anything else, and it's just like this almost monolithic thing. And my philosophy behind the framework was, well, okay, WebGL canvas is something that's actually very interesting, but it's more interesting if this 3D content is enhanced by all these other HTML5 APIs. Since I'm trying to make something that targets the WebGL enabled browsers, I'll be able to also use all these other things, such as web workers and forms and images, audio and video with my WebGL app. And so a way to see this is, for example, you could load your huge models onto a web worker, which is a separate thread, and once you have it done, you can get back that information and render it onto WebGL canvas. Or for example, you can use images and video as textures for your 3D model. So you can basically paste a video into a canvas and get the RGBA array from the canvas and put it back onto your 3D objects. And another interesting thing that you can do, for example, is try to use XHR2, so the binary array buffer options of the HTTP request, and try to sort of like compress your models having binary files instead of text files. So instead of JSON, having a binary file, and be able to load this into a typed array and use it as a means to load bigger models. So all these things can be combined to enhance the WebGL 3D experience. I'm going to show a couple of examples of this. Okay. So what this does is it takes a video, an HTML5 video, and for each frame of the video, it pastes that video into a 2D canvas. That way you can get the RGB array from the 2D canvas. And once you get the RGB array, you can show it on different ways. In this case, this is an RGB cube. So each point of the RGB cube is an R, G, and B component, right? And the circles get bigger whether there are more pixels in the screen that have this particular color. So what's neat about this is that this is done in real time. And there's a lot of data going back and forth from the HTML5 video to the 2D canvas to the WebGL scene. You can use different color schemes. For example, you can have an RGB array. You can also have HSL or HSV. If you're a designer, probably you know more about this than me. But there are different 3D representations for each color component. And you can also move to a different frame the video, and everything will happen in real time. So in this case, we're interacting with different components, not only having the WebGL scene, but also having HTML5 video, 2D canvas, and using forms and others to change the different options of the visualization. So the other example is the one that Luz showed before. So using imagery data from NASA in order to render a more compelling visualization of the weather, how the temperature changes. One of the interesting features of PhiloGL is the fact that it's, I put all my knowledge of building HTML5 frameworks into this framework, so I think that it's more like idiomatic JavaScript, more familiar to those who use JavaScript on a daily basis. It is built with a rich module system, so small modules, and you can eventually you could make your own build of the framework just by using the models you want. So if you don't want to have anything to do with web workers, you can just throw that and use the rest of the framework. So that makes it flexible and performance-focused in the sense that you can have a small footprint and you can use this on mobile devices, mobile applications. It also has, for example, an event system that covers all touch events and things like that. And I think that it has a fairly complete documentation of all these modules. So what about this idiomatic JavaScript thing means? I think that what it means is that it makes the code concise and more expressive. This is an example, for example, of a WebGL application. And the main idea is that you use only one function to create the application, which is the main entry point for your WebGL app, which is this PhiloGL function. And you pass in as a first argument the canvas ID, and as a second argument, you pass in a lot of options. So for example, and these options are kind of divided by sections. So you could configure your camera within your scene and set the position of that camera, or you could load textures from images, so you can pass in an array of images. And you could have handles for different events, so if you're dragging an object, if you're using your mouse wheel or scroll. And all these options will be fed to the WebGL app. And once this loads, all these things are prepared, it will call a callback on the onLoad event. If there's an error, then the onError handle will be called. I can actually show a working example of this. This is just a moon, a textured moon, and you have some drag events for this. So you can see the code at the right. So in the right, you have a moon, which is a sphere. And I'm creating a sphere, and I'm setting how many vertices for latitude and longitude I want for my sphere, and what texture to use with the sphere. So I'm using a moon.gif file, and I'm using this as a texture for the moon. Then I'm loading this application, setting some options for the camera and the textures, and some events too. So dragging events for dragging the moon, and other things such as lighting. So the model system is not only focused, as I said before, on WebGL, but also focused on other things that are around WebGL that could be useful. So, for example, a math module having vectors and matrices and having the fact of being able to use these typed arrays, which are really fast in order to compute this math. Program and shader management. So all I said before about writing your vertex and fragment shaders and how to compile them into a program, this is very easy with PhiloGL because we already provide a model for this. And actually, you don't even have to write your own shaders if you don't want to. I provide an O3D model that has simple primitives like spheres and cones and things like that that you can send in and render. And then high-level things such as a camera, a scene, how to handle events, how to handle different effects, and more advanced things like how to use web workers. So, for example, you can spawn the number you want of web workers and then join all that information together for your apps. And then I have a media model which handles video and images and how to feed them as textures for different models. So I'm going to show a couple of examples of what can be done with this. This is a recent example. What it does is I took information from different wind motion patterns in the US and tried to map this information from all these weather stations, which are more than, I think there are 1,500 weather stations. Try to track the patterns of the wind in the US for the last 72 hours. So you can hover each weather station here and see the information of the weather station, the elevation, and temperature, and wind direction. The wind direction is encoded by these lines, angle, and the wind speed is encoded by the radius of the circle. So you can play this 72-hour motion of the winds and kind of spot different patterns. For example, if you go over to this to Mount Washington, you can see that with time it gets bigger and bigger. And I thought that that was like an outlier of the data, but actually I checked with people working at that observatory, and they told me, no, this is what's actually happening. Like for 76 years, we had a world record of wind speed in the world. And you can also spot like different wind corridors from the east to the west. Here at the bottom, you have a slider in which you can go exactly to the point that you want in time and check that in more detail. You can also change different the markers or visual encodings for this. So I think that this one shows a little bit better the direction of the winds. And this one solely focuses on this, on the wind direction and speed. So from the initial stage of having the data and parsing the data, right, and creating these models, which are done with binary information, until rendering, it took me a day, and because the framework is really focused on, you know, handling this data to render it in some interesting fashion. Another similar example is of data visualization is world flights. This example, what it does is it takes data from about 57,000 flight routes from different airlines, and you can check these flying routes and how actually connect different cities to each other. By checking each airline, the planet will be centered over on that airline. You can actually rotate this, and if you hover a city, it will show you that. So I'm using like a picking algorithm, which is built in into the framework, to track exactly what city you're intercepting with your mouse. You can also uncheck the different cities and. Just overall watch it animate. So I also use a post-processing. So part of the media model is to be able to render two different type of things. You might see like some sort of neon effect around the lines and around the planet. And this is achieved by rendering the whole scene into a frame buffer, which is not the actual screen, but a data structure which represents a screen. And then render another scene into a frame buffer. And then combining these two frame buffers into something that is eventually rendered in the screen. So it's like a post-processing of an image, something that, you know, sometimes you may do on Photoshop or something like that. You can blur an image. Well, here you can do the same thing. You can render the image onto a frame buffer and then manipulate this frame buffer to render it to the screen eventually. And each of those it's called like a pass. You can do different passes. So blur can be achieved, for example, in one pass, or it can be achieved on two passes, and this changed dramatically the overall complexity of the algorithm. So other examples, this one, it's works kind of slow here, but I still wanted to show it. This one, what it does is it uses the worker group model. So what it does is it divides the 3D space into 8 different octants, just like a plane has quadrants, right? So it uses 8 workers, and on each worker it computes an 1/8 of the graphic you're seeing here. And once this computation is done, we're grouping all this information together and rendering it on the screen. So we're using this because the algorithm used to create these balls is kind of CPU intensive, so we can divide this algorithm into 8 smaller parts. We can also change the cube map reflections on the algorithm, which is pretty interesting. And another thing people like to do is just to use the media model to render just do this generative art thing in which they use, in this case, this is also fractal, and you can render it only to a plane and using all the code in a fragment shader to do this rendering. So basically, there's almost no JavaScript code for this. Most of the logic resides in the fragment shader, so it's written in this shading language, sort of like C-like language, which is very fast compared to JavaScript. And the only thing we're doing is just like sending the information of the camera is here, and there's a plane over there, and that's pretty much it. And the fragment shader takes care of computing all these pixels for you. You can change these different options for each for the visualization to see see it move X, Y, Z, and W in this case. It's the same notion as the fractal before, but this time taken into a 3D.
So these are some of the other resources that I mentioned. So hopefully you have seen enough to get started doing your own WebGL applications. If you need more resources, there you can find in dev.opera.com an introduction to WebGL. Sorry, the network is so slow. Well, we're going to upload this presentation later somewhere we haven't decided yet, but we're probably going to tweet about it later when we decide where to upload. Sorry. Let's see if it loads.
I don't think it will.
Yeah. No, maybe I would just mention them. So, well, of course, the PhiloGL library. Will this one?
No.
No, not really. Well, sorry about that. There's also a full tutorial for PhiloGL. This is, I think, a couple of 16, 20 lessons that will that explain how to use PhiloGL from creating a really simple rectangle to creating some of the more interesting examples that we showed later, like the moon or the two objects orbiting each other, up to how to create some textures. And then we have also in dev.opera.com information about how to use WebGL without a library if you feel particularly bold. Also, porting 3D models to WebGL. This is a tutorial that explains how you can use any 3D graphics software like Blender or Google SketchUp to create your 3D models, and then how you can export this to a portable format so then you can upload them to your WebGL application. So in this way, you can create, you can just draw any model you feel like, really complex models, and then you can just upload them and render them in WebGL. Then for some news and resources, the Learning WebGL blog is pretty good. There you get updates and you get links to several resources. And also for WebGL without a library, the Learning WebGL blog has some lessons. Well, then there's 3.js, and it also has its own tutorials. There's a WebGL FAQ. Probably you can just Google this, or we can upload it later. I'm going to try again just to see if I'm lucky, because I'm stubborn. But oh, yeah, there it goes. Rewarded. So you have this WebGL frequently asked questions with a lot more information in case you need this to get started. And finally, the Kronos WebGL forum, where you can find people that are also discussing different WebGL themes and help for whatever you may need. So, well, like I said, we're planning to upload the slides later. We don't know where yet, but this, if you follow our Twitter accounts, we will probably let you know. And yeah, that's it. And well, we have a lot of time for questions. If there's anything else that you would like to know.
Yes.
Is the WebGL context like the canvas context, and that is we pass in a kind of a static speech, static moment in time. This is where it is now, and WebGL doesn't handle any of the tweening or transformations for you.
Yeah, no. It is like the 2D context in the sense that you grab the context the same way. Once you grab the WebGL context, you cannot grab the 2D context from the same canvas, which is kind of a bummer because I would like to have that blending thing. But yeah, the API is very low level. There is no notion of scene or models whatsoever. It's no timeline, nothing. So that's why I would really suggest to rely more on frameworks because they build all these high-level structures and models, primitives, a scene, lighting, and all that that actually doesn't exist on WebGL. The only thing that exists because of the API is so similar to a C++ API, right? The only thing that you have is how to handle vertex attributes, so basically how to handle an array of floats, and that's pretty much it.
Questions, please come to the mic. I noticed that for mobile, WebGL is only supported so far in looks like Opera and Mozilla. When do you anticipate WebGL support for mobile WebKit?
Unfortunately, I don't know. I wish sooner than never.
Can the audience answer?
Oh. Ken Russell from Google.
Hi. So I work on Chrome. Sony has actually open sourced their WebKit WebGL implementation for Xperia phones. Unfortunately, in Chrome, the architecture is radically different, and it's only technical reasons why it's not in Chrome on Android yet. So it's hopefully coming soon to more WebKit-based web browsers.
Hello. Network notwithstanding, what's the biggest data sets you've been able to render in WebGL?
The biggest data set?
Yes.
What do you mean network notwithstanding?
Like, because you'd have to download the data set.
Yes.
So, ignoring that.
I can't really tell about that.
Okay. Because we do some rendering of very large data sets in the browser, but we use a VNC session in a Java applet and actually offload it to backend servers and do all the rendering on the servers. Mm. But then we're stuck with this Java applet, which is horrible.
Yeah. And well, the good thing about using the XHR2 API is that you can put your models into a binary format, and then you can load that asynchronously. So you don't really have to load the entire scene at the same time, but you can rely on the fact that all these different parts are loaded asynchronously, and you can load this as binary objects. So in most cases, those things are good things to try it out. But I cannot tell, like, you can load N vertices, because that really depends on many things.
Right, okay.
Hello. Hey. Can you talk at all about the hardware requirements? Because what kind of percentage of people you'd actually reach with a WebGL?
And what kind of, percentage?
What kind of percentage of people you'd actually reach with a WebGL app?
Oh. Most of the people coming to the framework side, that's the only thing I can tell you about, are using Chrome.
Yeah, but like more of a hardware requirement, because there's a video card requirement, right?
Yeah, there is. So there's actually like a whitelist and a blacklist of drivers that you can have for your GPU cards. But I don't really know what that list is. In general, like, it's pretty new hardware that you can use. In general, the things that change with different hardware is how you can actually what you can actually do inside of your shader code. Sometimes you can use a for loop. Sometimes you cannot use an index variable inside of a for loop, and you're stuck with having to write more simpler shader code, for example. So a really interesting tool related to that is GLSL Unit, because it lets you unit test the shaders before you can actually run something. So a good way of kind of like feature detect whether your computer is good for doing some rendering is not only to check whether you can grab the context, but also whether all the tests on the shaders you're going to be using pass with this machine. But I had my framework being rendered with, you know, software rendering and not only GPU rendering, and things were rendering okay. So Yeah, it really depends on the computer.
Do you think it's like 20%, 50%, 80%, or like any rough guess at all?
I don't really have a number.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know because some WebGL is also supported partially, so you would see something or you would see...
Yeah. So for example, you can render like a WebGL graphic into a 10 by 10 canvas, and you wouldn't be able to render it into a 1024x248 because it also depends on that too. So it's kind of like very browser, hardware, platform specific.
Yeah, but I think in any case, all new hardware supports WebGL. So this is sort of a problem that in time is solving itself, right? Or, I mean, with time, it will solve itself. It's not that some people are completely ignoring it. So you can expect more and more support over time.
Hi. My question is about working with popular, you know, I work for an agency, and we have 3D models and a bunch of different CAD packages and popular 3D animation packages. And my question is, do you have any experience or thoughts on what file formats or what processes for exporting stuff from those packages maybe works better than others? I know there's a lot of different file formats that are supported by the different frameworks out there, but is there one that you think is preferred or like easier to work with for moving stuff from an artist to a developer?
Most of the people use OBJ, like Wavefront or Collada files. What I wouldn't recommend is to rely on the client side to parse those files in order to create your models you're building, because that will take a lot of time and you don't really want to do that. I would prefer to do this offline, so kind of convert these OBJ or Collada files into some more interesting binary format that you can load, for example, on the client side, and just load that model and render it. Not do any large processing of the model in order to render it into the screen.
Yeah, and also one thing is that you have multiple tools or scripts, the scripts that right now export from the different 3D graphic software to the different formats that you may need, and that convert the files also from these formats to binary. And the quality that you will get largely depends on which of these converting tools you will use. So, probably you just need to take a look at the available tools and experiment with that, because the quality that you can get from using different software packages and using different exporting and converting tools is really variable.
You mentioned the possibility of optimizing for processing data, not just the visuals. And do you have any good examples? Like, I'm just thinking, you know, matrix manipulation from like linear algebra type stuff, specifically around like, I don't know if you know constraint programming or like, you know, job scheduling optimization, anything like that.
So what kind of techniques one could use in order to process data? Is that the...
Yeah. Any good examples or...
Anything? Yeah. So, to process data, like to do GPGPU, or to process data, like to use JavaScript stuff to render things?
Yeah, so, no, I'm thinking more like...
GPGPU.
Yeah, you know, let's say, I'll give you an exact specific thing. So, I don't know if you're familiar with constraint solvers. Like, there's one called Cassowary. It's for resolving cyclic dependencies in linear arithmetic, and you set up like a kind of a... Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would be better solved like with things coming eventually, like WebCL and stuff like that, being
like,
able
to
WebCL, which is a standard that allows you to do GPGPU programming. So general purpose GPU programming.
Oh, okay.
So you can have mathematical functions being run on the GPU, and that would be a lot faster because the GPU is designed to do math, right? So you could solve equations and do stuff like that in the GPU and then get back the results. But when you're dealing with WebGL, you're kind of like constrained to send a specific data structure over to the shaders, right? So in this case, for example, something that would be interesting to do math-wise would be to send an array of numbers and to have them transformed on the vertex shader, and then read the pixels back from that image into another array that is transformed with the math.
So you got to like proxy through the pixels, though, kind of thing.
Yeah, so what you would do is like have a typed array, which is a float array of floats, for example, and you send that over as if it was a vertex array, but it's not. It's just an array of numbers, right? And then you transform that on the vertex shader, and you paint them into a screen. Once you have them into a screen, you can do read pixels from the WebGL API, and you read the pixels back, and you have your array back. So like people can do that, for example, to do audio manipulation before when there wasn't the audio API and all that. You could send in an array of floats that would represent the audio data, and then read the pixels from whatever you transformed and use them as audio afterwards.
Yeah. Any good audio examples you know of? Or anything?
Yeah, like so from... If you think about what the vertex shader does and how it can transform these pixels, and if you can think of anything that would be a good analogy to that spatial transforming, then for example, if you have sound, you could have echo, because it's like the same kind of thing.
That makes sense.
So what
yeah.
he's saying is that yeah, it's like better used or optimized for anything from which the data can be seen as a good analogy to the spatial processing that you have.
Thanks.
Okay.
I noticed on that that Metaball web workers example, you had 8 different web workers. Do you get some hardware acceleration from that, or is that just to keep the UI from getting locked up? What's the impact on that?
Well, web workers can be used to have the UR thread be only using the UI and not having to process this data. But also using multiple workers can allow you to, well, divide the complexity of the algorithm by the number of workers you're using. So in this particular case, if we were dealing with real threads as web workers, we would be able to, or processes or whatever, we would be able to have an eighth of the computation on each worker, and then gather all that information back and be able to render it back to the screen. So in theory, it should be faster. Okay, no more questions. Thanks a lot.